Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
A couple years ago, I was in Fort Madison, Iowa to visit a friend over Labor Day weekend, and when I got to town, it was early Saturday evening. I had some time to kill, so I crossed the Mississippi River into Illinois and drove about 15 minutes to a town called Nauvoo because I'd heard it was a community rich in history, particularly with respect to the Mormon community that once inhabited the area in the early 1840s. Everything was closed for the evening, but I drove by the Mormon temple there, and it looked like a small state capitol building or perhaps a large courthouse. I didn't get too excited about Nauvoo, went back to Fort Madison, and enjoyed my weekend there. But then I read Benjamin Park's fascinating new book, Kingdom of Nauvoo, which tells the story of Joseph Smith and his Mormon followers' sojourn along the Mississippi River there, and now I can't wait to go back. And Benjamin Parks joins me now. Ben, the Mormons came to Nauvoo late 1830s, early 1840s, or what came to be called Nauvoo, after fleeing Ohio and Missouri. Why were they fleeing those other locations, and why was Nauvoo supposed to be any different for them?
Well, ever since the Mormon Church was founded, they had faced a steep opposition, in part due to their own radical activities that threatened that at least to their neighbors seemed threatening to the Democratic Society, but also because of they just seemed different. They seemed like they didn't fit into American culture. So while Mormonism was founded up in upstate New York and Pennsylvania, and then they eventually moved to Ohio and then eventually to Missouri, in each place they faced a pretty steep opposition. And Missouri was probably the worst. They faced a state-sanctioned mob, including at one point the state governor, Lilburn Boggs, signing an executive order that declared that the Mormons were nuisances, enemies of the state, who must either be exterminated or driven from Missouri's boundaries, which is what drove them out in the dead of winter of 1838-39 onto Illinois soil.
You write that sacrifice was a common theme for Mormon women. How so?
Yeah, well, one of the most common activities for Mormon men were being sent out to be missionaries. And so from the very early years, Mormon women had to learn how to get on with things without their husbands and fathers at home, which could be quite tough in a frontier society where every meal was hard fought. And then once they reached in Nauvoo, if that was enough, a lot of Mormon women would be called into high religious positions that would take a lot of their time and duties and draw a lot of attention. And then the doctrine of polygamy originates in Nauvoo, which is going to ask sacrifice from women even more when they're asked for their husbands to share their wives.
In Illinois, there was a permissive charter from the state government that gave the Mormons this land in Nauvoo. Can you kind of explain how that worked?
Yeah, when the Mormons arrived in Illinois, they arrived at a very opportune time. Illinois was pretty divided politically between the two parties at the time, the Whigs and the Democrats, and both parties were very eager to court the Mormon vote because they knew that these thousands of Mormon converts coming in were going to be quite influential in the coming up elections in the next few years. And so they were willing to do whatever they could, bend over backwards to get the Mormons what they wanted. One of these was granting them a very generous city charter, which kind of took the most radical provisions of all the recent charters that were passed for other cities in the past 5 years and combined them together. And even more than that, besides what the charters actually said, the Mormon saints interpreted that charter even more broadly. So what it did is it gave them basically the power to be a city-state. They had the authority to raise their own city militia, which they called the Nauvoo Legion. At its height, it had 3,000 armed men, which was larger than the state sitting militia. It also gave them expanded judicial powers after a series of city resolutions over the next few years. They had the power to try any arrest warrant that originated outside of the city, which meant that whenever Missouri or the state of Illinois had problems with Joseph Smith, Nauvoo felt that, well, we have a say on it first to make sure that this isn't just some anti-Mormon scheme. To non-Mormon neighbors, of course, this all seemed like legal loopholes that allowed the Mormons, these deluded fanatics establishing their own religious theocracy, a chance to govern themselves without being brought to justice.
Was there a difference or a noticeable difference between the government of the city of Nauvoo and the government of the LDS Church?
No. There would be a few people who would be serving in city positions who were not members of the LDS faith, but they still had to kind of cast their allegiance to Joseph Smith. I think it all comes down to Joseph Smith as the linchpin that holds both the city and the church governance together. As long as you're willing to get along with Joseph Smith and follow his dictates, you could live pretty comfortably in Nauvoo, which a few non-Mormon residents did. But as soon as you challenged Joseph Smith, as a growing number of things did in 1843 and 1844, that's when a lot of problems would occur.
The temple that's in Nauvoo now is a replica, but when the cornerstone was laid for the new temple back in the 1840s, you describe in the book a celebration, a large parade, a dedicatory speech by Sidney Rigdon. What would we see if we could travel back in time and watch that celebration?
Oh, man, I don't know if we would have seen a celebration on a similar scale throughout Illinois. The temple was supposed to be the capstone of the Nauvoo experience. It's sitting on the bluff overlooking the still-developing city below. It was going to be built of a white limestone. It was going to have a huge pillar on the front. Everyone was going to flock from the region. In fact, the Mormons assumed that it was going to be a tourist destination. That was one way they were going to make money. And these celebrations, they not only had pomp and circumstance and parades and a band and a choir, but they also were a chance for the Nauvoo militia, the Nauvoo Legion, to flex their muscle a bit as well, to kind of show that this is a powerful city. So there would be lots of dignitaries that would come throughout the state to witness what they had allowed to happen. And there was one nearby resident, Thomas Sharp, who was the editor of the nearby Warsaw Signal, who came and saw this big celebration, and he came away terrified. He said, "Oh no, we have allowed a theocratic military government to establish on our shores, and if they continue unabated, we're going to have some serious problems."
It was in Nauvoo where Joseph Smith introduced the practice of vicarious baptisms of the dead and then this endowment ritual to initiate members. How did those all work?
Yeah, the first few years of Nauvoo was an especially ripe time for Joseph Smith's theology innovation. Now, the Mormon Church has already been quite religiously unique by this point, but now nestled in Illinois and in their mind free from opposition, Joseph Smith was able to promulgate a number of doctrines that became crucial to the LDS faith even today. Among these were vicarious baptism for the dead, in which those who died before having a chance to accept the gospel are given a chance to be baptized vicariously by those living in Nauvoo. And the saints of Nauvoo were so excited by this new doctrine that they flooded the Nauvoo, the Mississippi River, to do these baptisms. And one of my favorite accounts comes from a woman by the name of Valet Kimball, who said that the waters were continuously troubled by the men and women going down to be baptized for one another to make sure that their deceased relatives could survive. But there are other doctrines that originate out of this as well, especially those doctrines connected to that temple. Joseph Smith believed that this temple was the vehicle through which God was going to reestablish his priesthood authority to once again restore order to an otherwise chaotic world.
I think a lot of us immediately think of polygamy when we think of the Mormon Church. How did that practice, well, it came about there, but how did it jive with the rest of the non-Mormon world of the day?
Not well. Polygamy originated at the same time as these other radical doctrines, and at the same time as Joseph Smith's radical political proposals as well, in which all of these practices and ideas were wedded to the same ideological principles. Namely, that the society of men had become so chaotic, so anarchic, democracy had led to anarchy, and so God's priesthood order was going to restore control. And so at the same time that Joseph Smith is preaching these new temple doctrines, emphasizing this new priesthood authority, preaching this political unity, he's also introducing polygamy, what they eventually came to call the Abrahamic order, whereas righteous patriarchs would be able to serve over their priesthood kingdoms of several women and eventually numerous offspring. Now, this remains a secretive practice for all of Joseph's life, even if the rumor starts creaking out, but it causes lots and lots of problems because there are lots of people in Nauvoo. There are, of course, some who embrace the doctrine and see Joseph Smith as a prophet, and lots of women who are able to justify polygamy as a way that brings redemption to an otherwise a fallen world. But there are also lots of people who see polygamy as a degradation of their morals, as a betrayal of their religious beliefs. And so that ends up causing a growing schism in the church that causes Joseph Smith's biggest problems since Nauvoo's founding.
I'm chatting with Benjamin Parks about his new book, Kingdom of Nauvoo. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold, assuming you can find a bookstore open anymore. But nonetheless, they're available out there. Ben, you really mined a lot of new material that's been released about the Council of 50, this governing body that Smith convened in Nauvoo. What did you find when you first started poring over those documents, which had been hidden away for a long time?
Yeah, these documents are perhaps the most exciting development in the study of early Mormonism, and I would argue early American religion as well. Now, Joseph Smith, when he is going off to Carthage Jail in June of 1844, where he's eventually killed, he turns to the secretary for this council and says, you need to go burn those minutes. And we're very fortunate that he decides not to burn them. Instead, he buries them. But those minutes might as well have stayed buried because they were restricted from believers and skeptics alike for over 170 years until they were finally released just a few years ago. And when I finally got these documents, long mythologized in the LDS tradition and historical circles, my heart started beating so fast because I read through these documents and I saw immediately the most potent expression of democratic discontent that I found in early America. Now, the Council of 50 was an organization that Joseph founded just the last few months of his life when he felt that the walls were closing in on him and his people, and they were going to have to find a much more radical proposal to save humanity. So rather than just saving the democratic system through electoral practices, they were going to establish a new government system, in their explicit words, a theocracy. And so they established this Council of 50, which was a colloquial term for what, for a council, they called the Kingdom of God. And this Kingdom of God was supposed to restore order. It's based around priesthood authority. And they were going to establish a theocratic kingdom somewhere on the Western frontier. And this becomes what I argue the most radical religious and political proposal in antebellum America. But what also struck me about these minutes were cultural sentiments that could be found throughout the rest of America, a fear that America had run its course and was about to fall apart, a fear that America was overlooking eternal laws of God and that they'd need to return back to divine dictates that they were going to restore order. Those are similar sentiments and ideas that you find throughout America, especially as the sectional crisis starts heating up between slavery and anti-slavery states, as they argue that the American Constitution may not be fully equipped to solve these major problems and it might be time to start something new. Now, lots of people are thinking that Mormons take that idea and run with it, perhaps to a much more radical degree than any of their contemporaries, and the Council of 50 is probably the pinnacle of that radicalism.
I had no idea, and I'm ashamed to admit, before I read your book, that Joseph Smith was a presidential candidate in 1844. At the beginning of your book, he's meeting with President Martin Van Buren at the White House in Washington and other senators, and then Joseph Smith becomes the first presidential candidate to be assassinated. Was his political campaign a serious one?
You know, I think in 2020 America, we've probably gotten a bit open to ideas of radical outsider presidential candidates, but Joseph Smith probably stretches that characteristic even further. By 1843, when the Saints feels like they burned all their bridges with the state political parties and they felt that they had to turn to the federal government for help, they send out letters to the five leading presidential candidates who are going to be running for the White House the next year and ask, if you are elected, what would you do to help the Mormons? Of those five they write to, only three respond. Of those three who responded, none proposed help. So Mormons, in their desperate plea, decide, well, if no one's going to represent us, we are going to represent ourselves. So they nominate Joseph Smith as the presidential candidate. Now, to answer your question, I'm not sure that Joseph Smith ever thought he had a real shot to become president. To be able to win an electoral college, meaning you have to win all these different states, was a bit far-fetched. But they went about this, what I see as a publicity campaign, with gusto. They send out several hundred missionaries throughout the nation to spread not just Joseph Smith's gospel vision, but now his political platform. They're going to hold state conventions in every convention to nominate Joseph Smith, and he goes through a series of potential running mates. And then eventually he's killed before before the election actually takes place. Now, I don't think that most Saints thought that he was a serious candidate, but they saw that this is a protest campaign, a chance to spread their message and show that the democratic order was not working for everyone, and it might be time to look at federal power and federalism a bit differently than they had before.
Were these 19th century Mormons a cult on the fringes of society, or were they really a beleaguered religious minority, or is there an answer to that?
Yeah, the term cult is usually deployed in different circumstances. In many cases, it means the church is small that I don't agree with. And so there's definitely many of Nauvoo's contemporaries who saw them as a cult who needs to be handled with. Mormons, of course, saw themselves as a religious minority, those who do not share the majoritarian principles of America, and what is there to protect their rights when a majority culture disapproves of them? They argued that the way democracy was set up, minority groups could never get their day in court. They could never be able to assure their rights because they are seen as unpopular to a majority of society. Now, I think there are lessons that we can take from this, because a lot of the same arguments that the saints are being made of how they as a minority church should have their rights preserved end up becoming sacralized in law several decades later. After the Civil War, the Americans see the federal government as the arbiter to make sure that all individual groups should be able to have their rights observed. And so after the Civil War, the federal government is going to be the arbiter to make sure that the Bill of Rights and the constitutional principles are relegated to all individual citizens. Now, the Mormons are making that argument as early as the 1840s. Now, we don't know how systematic or coherent those arguments are, but I think those sentiments are currently there. So I think today in America, we at least prize ourselves in certain segments that we are able to assimilate groups who are a minority faith and otherwise who might be overtrodden in a majoritarian culture. Back in 19th century, that wasn't very much the case, and I think the Mormons remind us of that difficult history.
Well, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading this book. It was not only just a history of the church, it's an American history story. It's about the frontier and the antebellum period, and it's just a fascinating read. The book is Kingdom of Nauvoo by Benjamin Parks. The book's available wherever your fine books are sold. Ben, just an absolute pleasure talking to you about it, and great job with the book.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be on.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Fair city of Joseph, we bid you adieu. Farewell for a season, farewell to Nauvoo. Farewell to the temple.